ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of the most ambitious projects in human history.
It's almost like the atomic bomb in terms of its transformational effect.
For decades, the breakthrough has been just around the corner.
That would bring our financial markets and electronic commerce to a grinding halt.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Binge the whole series now. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Science Show, music and how it's woven into maths, physics, nature, just about everything, really.
Find out that mathematical principles discovered by Pythagoras are present in music penned by Bach.
Learn how a thrumming, humming MRI machine might help in the search for dark matter.
And pay homage to Bill Oddi, who encouraged generations to tune their ears to the natural world. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Robin, you're much more of a classical music aficionado than I am. I'm more of a fan of Beck than Bach.
Yes, you know I'm very fond of Bach, both C.P.E. Bach, Carl to his father, Johann Sebastian, and now even more so as a book just published, which has a lively chapter about how come the Bach family thought so much of science and especially of maths. The chapter is by supreme violinist and artistic director of the Bach Academy, Australia. Academy with a K, Madeline.
It's spelt that way to pay homage to our German musical roots of Bach. And I thought, so many people just anglicise everything, and my audience are intelligent people, and I'm not going to patronise them by putting things in the English. I'm going to give them the real authentic German spelling of Academy.
And also, with the new book, a number of authors. How many authors?
I think it's about 12.
And you're one of them?
I am indeed.
And it's called?
Harmony of the Spheres, Ancient and Recent Perspectives.
And it's got so much science in it. How come?
It's got so much science in it because the concept of the harmony of the spheres is such a scientific one by nature.
Planets and so on?
Yes, indeed. I think the original concept of it was that if you tuned in to the cycles and revolutions of the planets, you could hear the harmony. It would actually create notes, which if you tuned in enough, you could actually hear.
Now, your chapter about mathematics and Bach is, for me, a revelation. Because I began to think, okay, there might be coincidental things in the ways in which music is written up that's symmetrical and therefore mathematical. But I had no idea that someone like Bach would use mathematics actually as a basis for composition.
I'm not sure he used it as the pure basis for composition. It's my gut feeling that he used it as a way of balance, as a way of making sense of nature, the universe. And in that way, he could make sense of his music. He could create something, for example, symmetrical. He was very fond of symmetry in his music. And I think because mathematics exists in nature all the time and in space and in the cycles and revolutions of the planets, it should also exist in music. And he was right, because if you think of who discovered music? Pythagoras, of course, the ultimate mathematician. And he was the first one to discover that the ratio of an octave is 1 to 2, and that if you cut an octave in half, you get a fifth above, and so on and so forth. These mathematical principles of music are inherent in Bach's music, as you rightly pointed out.
Is that the golden ratio?
No, it's not. I think that's more like 2 to 3.
These things emerge from the way music is composed. It's not, if you like, a formula that was used to make music.
No, and if you start composing like that, you get into the realms of the second Viennese school of Schoenberg and Alban Berg and Webern and all those. The people.
Plinky, plonky, plonk.
Well, yeah, maybe, yes. It's certainly not harmony-based. That's it. That's assigning a note a number and just randomly making tone rows out of numbers. No, it absolutely wasn't. I think Bach had these mathematical proportions embedded in his music to give them a sense of rightness and correctness, and as if the music does exist within nature. But I certainly don't believe, not even for a second, that he would compose a piece of music based on its mathematical ratio.
And what you write about is that there is a mathematical code that you can actually discover in the music.
When you analyse it, you'll find the numbers there, but it wasn't based on that, if you know what I mean.
Because I don't play anything. I listen intently. And I kept on wondering how it is, as I look down at the orchestra, that there are some people there counting bars for God knows how long, and then coming in, okay, they look at the conductor so they know when to come in just to confirm it. But what if you count wrong?
Oh, well, yes. Well, then you'll make it, and yes, what do we call them? A drive-by solo.
I see. Does the audience usually notice?
Well, it depends how big the drive-by solo is.
Okay, so describe your chapter. What does it say?
My chapter is about Bach's relationship to the harmony of the spheres. And I'm so pleased that the editors of the book, Ken Parry and Dean Rickles, wanted to include an entire chapter about Bach in this book, especially when it's so science-based elsewhere. And I think it was really insightful of them to do this because it brought in music to the equation. And out of any composer I could ever think of, it was Bach who was most closely musically related to the harmony of the spheres. It's fascinating when you think about where Bach grew up and what he had around him. He had almost no scientific or mathematical training at all. In Eisenach, a tiny little provincial town in Thuringia, incidentally where Martin Luther was imprisoned under house arrest for all those years during the Reformation. So there he was, this little school kid in a pretty rough school getting bullied and, you know, having brawls every lunchtime in the schoolyard and everything else. But he had this kind of a brain that was intrinsically tuned to balance and nature. And then when he got a little bit older and began working for the church, I believe that he really clung to his faith because he was orphaned at the age of 9. He had to go and live with his older brother up the road in Ohrdruf, who he barely knew, who was 13 years older than him. He was basically kicked out of home when he was 16 because they couldn't feed him. They said, you've got to go get a job, go and get a job. So he did. Incidentally, as a violinist, not as an organist. And all of these experiences, I think, gave him a real pragmatism at a very, very young age. And thanks to his innate temperament, he searched for order. He was looking for it. So when one is curious and when one looks for something, one finds it.
Is there a way, just to be cheeky, that you can demonstrate just one of the principles that you mentioned in the beginning on your violin?
I can demonstrate the harmonic series is that Pythagoras discovered when he blew through that seashell on the beach all those thousands of years ago. Yeah, because the harmonic series or music is something that nature has produced for us. And anyone who's ever played a brass instrument will know that if they play one note and increase the pressure, the harmonic series just comes out on its own. And you can find it in a string. And that's where you can see the mathematical ratios in the position of the harmonics up the string. And the ratios keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller according to the harmonic series.
Could you show me?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay, so up here on the violin, there's a series of harmonics starting really from the very beginning of the string. Get higher up. There you find the harmonic series.
And you're not actually fingering those changes, it's just coming
they're
through.
They're there on their own.
Ah, I saw your finger going up and down then.
Yeah, so that's the bass note. Then the next one is the fifth. The next one is the octave. It's half again. Half again. Yeah, and you go all the way up. That is there without me having to put any fingers down.
Incredible. Built into the instrument.
Built in.
Just amazing. Tell me, were you trained in maths?
I am hopeless at maths. I failed every maths exam I ever did, unfortunately. Probably teachers who didn't have enough patience to teach me and mild dyslexia, to be honest.
Gosh. So how did you manage to write that masterful chapter?
With a lot of research, a lot of time, and a lot of redrafting and a lot of editing. The world according to Bach. I wrote that bit just to give people a bit of an overview as to what the world looked like when Bach was entering it and why it's even more remarkable that he had the scientific mind and the curiosity that he did to explore number relationships and to connect this world with the world up there, all the cycles and revolutions of the planets. So there is quite a lot about that. And then this idea of transcendence, the sublime and the divine, and that is all about the idea of Bach trying to build a bridge between Earth and the heaven and stars. Because if we think about it, this is pre-Enlightenment. So it's pre-science, it's pre all of the sort of ideas that we had to explain the universe. The only way Bach could explain his existence on the planet was through his belief and his divinity. And when he was writing his music, he would use musical forms such as the canon and the fugue in order to invoke natural law. And that's what this chapter is about. It's about the idea of invoking the natural law of the universe through music. And if you think about it, when we talk about what is in the canon is law, isn't it? And so writing a canon, a musical idea that will go around and around, is a way of musically invoking law. And the music doesn't work unless you follow the rules. Then there's the chapter about all the mathematics, which are innately in his music, and the symmetry, for example, in his B minor mass, it all hinges on the middle crucifixus, which is, of course, the most poignant and heartfelt moment of the entire mass. It's entirely built on a symmetrical structure, like a big pyramid, as his motet, Jesu meine Freude, 11 movements, one culminating in the sixth at the top, which is a fugue invoking law. And then there's the idea of cycles and revolutions in his music. So Bach wrote a lot of music in cycles. For example, his cantata cycles in his first 5 years in Leipzig, the solo sonatas and partitas, which have the magical D minor chaconne in it. Now, in that chaconne, there are 62 variations, and the apex of it follows the ratio of the golden mean, which is just staggering that he knew that. And in that work, written for one violin, not only do you find the mathematical relationships and the cycle of the ever-repeating bass line that goes over and over and over again, but you also go through an emotional journey. So Bach isn't just thinking about heavens and the stars and the earth. He's thinking about you as a human being and the cycle you go through in your life.
Especially if you're well-tempered.
Clever.
And the well-tempered clavier written by him as well?
Absolutely was. Yeah. And then that's
why is it well-tempered?
Wohltemperiert clavier. Well, a temperament was a tuning system. And again, we can go back to Pythagoras here, because he was the one who discovered the harmonic series, but he also discovered, or maybe he didn't discover this, people discovered much later on that if you stack, for example, a perfect fifth and a perfect fourth on top of each other, line it up next to an octave, they don't match. A perfect fifth and a perfect fourth is wider than an octave acoustically. And if you want to know more about this, there's a wonderful book called How Equal Temperament Ruined Harmony and Why You Should Care. It's a great book by Ross Duffin, and I give it to all my students to read because they need to know about this.
Where do you teach?
At the Sydney Conservatorium of Music High School.
Can you give me two bars of anything you like?
Sure. I will give you the opening of this magnificent D minor chaconne.
Madeleine Easton playing her beloved Bach. She wrote the chapter in the new book Harmony of the Spheres. But for an amateur like me, as you heard, maybe like you, Bell, we may have only the vaguest notion of how maths and music may be connected. So I turned to a friend, leading conductor and composer Christopher Bowen, trained in Melbourne and Vienna. So how much do the numbers count?
There are a number of things which bind music and mathematics together. For example, the proportions or ratios to achieve an octave, it's 2:1. If you have a string, you halve it. Ratio 2:1 gives you the octave. If you have a ratio of 3:2, you get the fifth. 4:3, you get the fourth.
But doesn't it depend on how long the string is?
Yes, it all depends. But generally, the ratio is always constant.
So that's known by various... When you went to Vienna to train as a conductor, was maths part of your education?
I think they presumed that we knew that. Where I studied in Melbourne, it was alluded to, but we didn't really study it. Later on, I became very, very interested in it. Within music, there is an implied logic. Bach is a perfect demonstration of that. The golden mean, the ratio 1.618, if you take the number of bars in a particular piece and you divide that number by 1.618, you come up with some really interesting things.
Well, you're a composer. Did you do that?
Not deliberately. From my reading, yes, Bach was very interested in mathematics. I don't think music was divorced from this wonderful thing called science. I think science and mathematics, they're all part of the same thing.
It's surprising given his rather humble background.
Yes, but he also was a genius and also had the benefit of being from a very, very musical family, stretching, 200 years. So there was an implied understanding in use of counterpoint. Counterpoint has certain laws to obey. They were built up. Whether or not they were consciously designed as a result of that, I'm not so sure, but I think there's an inherent understanding to those who are open to it, as in nature. We don't think of the Fibonacci theory as being relevant to nature, but it is.
Fibonacci, if you have one and you go to the next number, that's two, obviously. Yeah. You add them together, that's three. And the next one?
You take the preceding number and then you add it, five, the next number in the Fibonacci theory, 5 + 3 = 8. Coincidentally, guess what? That corresponds to how you build up harmony in music and dividing up the octave.
Harmony, yes. But Fibonacci is also one of the successive numbers in lots of plants, the growth of leaves.
Sunflowers.
Sunflowers.
Bartok apparently had sunflowers on his desk when he composed. He was aware of it. I do remember reading about that, and he had a deep interest in it. Bach too. So there are many, many reference points. For example, also in architecture, the Italian architect Palladio, I think, arranged architecture according to musical ratios.
As you prepare for your next concert, which in fact is this weekend, are you thinking of numbers in any way to rehearse all those voices and all those instruments?
Not obviously, but when I'm learning a piece, there is always an architecture in it, and so there, when I analyse it, numbers do come up. For example, the structure of a work. You'll have an exposition, then you'll have a development, then you'll have a return to the exposition, which is called a recapitulation. And so there's an inherent balance, much like building a structure. If the structure isn't sound, mathematically sound, it's going to fall down.
But you don't go to the score and do some numerical analysis and say, hey, this is going wrong just there, halfway down the page.
No, I don't think that. Yeah. As one becomes a seasoned musician, I think you inherit that logic, that knowledge, which is embedded. You may not be, some musicians are probably not aware of it, but they sense it. I've known musicians who have this incredible facility to do amazing things. When I was in Vienna, I came across a couple of them, one who was a wonderful teacher but couldn't make music.
But tell me, the crucial thing is for listeners who love their music and love their top 100 and so on, your audience in the Great Hall of University of Sydney, does it help us to prepare in any way mathematically to appreciate the music?
The sensitive listener is able to perceive that inner level. Whether or not it's on an intellectual level, no. And I don't think music is meant to be understood solely by the intellect. I think there's a marriage between the intellect, the emotional, the spiritual, the soulful. And one is, I suppose, dependent on the other. But I'm not sure whether the mind should override everything. After all, I think politics and the horrors of the 20th century and the 19th century can tell us what the rational mind can do to us.
And what's finally the makeup of this week's concert?
We're doing a wonderful work by Jan Dismas Zelenka, who's a Bohemian composer. He was a contemporary of Bach. I discovered his music 50-odd years ago, and I was completely and utterly blown away by it. Not much is known about him. Bach knew of him because Zelenka was a musician in Dresden at the same time. And Bach actually got a couple of his sons to copy out some of his music. Consequently, since in the last 50 years, Zelenka's music has grown in stature as people have discovered it and recorded it. He's extraordinary. He's very esoteric. It's an adventure.
His name again?
Jan Dismas Zelenka.
And the other work is Vivaldi?
Vivaldi, of course, the iconic Gloria. But the Zelenka is truly out of the box, and it's a really exciting work.
Christopher Bowen, conductor of the Sydney University Graduate Choir and composer of the Redfern Oratorio. And Bell, did you hear Andrew Ford present a music show a couple of weeks ago with melodies based on DNA? And he wrote a work celebrating trees. So yes, music and science together are everywhere.
It's true, forever intertwined. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. Let's switch from what we hear to what we see, or at least trying to see. This is the search for dark matter. Now, we've been following this topic pretty closely on The Science Show, with Dan Falk last week reporting from a lab down a Canadian mine. That lab is searching for hypothetical dark matter particles called WIMPs. But WIMPs aren't the only candidate particles for dark matter. And to look for these other ones, there's no need to go down a mine. It's your typical grey old July day in Melbourne, but I'm in a good mood because I'm on my way to see a dark matter detector being switched on for the first time. This device has been years in the making and will be the first of its kind in Victoria to collect data about the mysterious stuff that makes up 85% of all the matter in the universe. But I'm not at the Stall Underground Physics Lab, which will search for dark matter from the bottom of an old gold mine. No. This detector is sitting in an MRI machine in the basement of a building at Swinburne University.
Nice to meet you.
Ben McAllister is the physicist leading this project. And today, he and his PhD students, Raj Singh and Paige Taylor, are starting their search for dark matter. We're standing in a room with a bunch of laptops and computers and other technical-looking gear.
So let's do the calibration data and then we can get going.
And through a large window, we can see into another room, which is where the MRI machine is. It looks like your standard MRI machine, with a movable bed that slides in and out of a big donut-shaped scanner. But instead of a person lying on the bed, today there's a copper cylinder there. It's about as wide as a wine bottle and not quite as long, and polished to a gleaming shine. This is the dark matter detector.
All right, here we go. We're about to take first data on our first dark matter detector here in the state of Victoria. Three, two, one.
You may have missed it, but that faint click was Raj hitting the enter key on the laptop.
There you go.
Numbers start filling the screen.
We're away. How exciting. That's
all right.
Anticlimactic.
We need a big lever
or something. Bell or something. All right. Yeah, we should replace that with a big cheers for dark matter.
Congratulations. Well, it's up and running, so yeah, that's great. How are you feeling, Raj?
Pretty excited taking the data, and you can also see in real time it is acquiring data. Let's see what the data looks like.
With the detector now up and running, Ben and I head out to a quiet room to chat about dark matter and how he can look for something when he doesn't even know what it is.
I like to think about dark matter as it's kind of the biggest mystery in the universe. We know that there is so much of this invisible stuff. It's all around us. It's passing through us right now. It's passing through you, the room you're in, the planet, and we just don't know what it is. There's about five times as much of it as there is all the stuff that makes up you and the planet and the sun and all the other stuff we can see with our telescopes in space. And we don't know what it's made of. Like, to me, that is just such a captivating mystery that when I first learned about that in undergrad, I was just like, oh, kind of don't know how I could do anything else. You know, it kind of really just grabbed my brain, and I've been, yeah, looking for it ever since.
Well, if you don't know what it is, how do you know what to look for?
The short answer is we use the scientific method. We form a hypothesis and we test it. So we don't know what it's made of, but that doesn't mean that we know absolutely nothing. We know it is dark, which means it doesn't give off light, so we can't see it. And we know it is matter, which means it has mass. And that is it that we know for sure. Usually what you do is you go looking for other areas of physics where there are outstanding questions that can be explained by the introduction of, say, like a new particle or something. And then if that new particle happens to have the properties that you would expect of dark matter, you can kind of go, okay, that's like a more well-motivated candidate for dark matter. And that's exactly what happened with the kind of dark matter that we're looking for today. We here at Swinburne are particularly interested in this dark matter candidate particle called the axion. It's actually named after a brand of dish soap, but that's a separate story.
I would like to hear that story, actually.
Sure. So the story goes, at least the lore, the legend of where the name axion came from is that the people who named the thing, I guess when they were grad students, they had this brand of dish soap in their house, axion dish soap, and they always thought it sounded like a cool name for a particle because it sounds like a particle. The particles tend to have the O-N suffix, like electron, proton, muon, gluon. And so then when they got the opportunity to name a hypothetical particle later in their career, they said, the axion. Also, it's dish soap. It's borrowed that name because the axion, they say in heavily inverted commas, cleans up problems in physics. So it's, yeah, physicists love stuff like that. But the axion comes from this other area in physics. It's called the strong CP problem. It's essentially like a big gaping hole in an otherwise very, very, very well-studied area of physics. The neutron, which is one of the tiny little particles that goes inside atoms, the theory that is otherwise incredibly precise at predicting the behavior of the neutron and other subatomic particles, predicts one thing wrong about the neutron. It predicts that the neutron should have what we call an electric dipole moment, which is just like a very slight separation of charge. Like it should have one very slightly positively charged end and one slightly negatively charged end, which we just don't observe. And that is an interesting thing in physics. If the model is 99% right, except for a little place where it's not, that tells you that there's something there that you don't understand yet. And that's called the strong CP problem. There is a widely regarded pretty compelling solution to the strong CP problem, which requires the introduction of a new particle. And when you introduce that particle, it has the properties that we expect dark matter to have, which is to say it has some small mass and very weakly interacting with other stuff around it. And so they named it the axion. And then a few years later, some people said, oh, maybe it could also be dark matter because it has the right properties.
Okay, so you've designed a detector to detect axions.
Yeah.
Can you just describe it and briefly, how does it work?
Like I said, the first thing you want to do when you make a detector or try to detect dark matter is you have to have an idea of what it is. So in our case, we're saying, okay, it's the axion. Then you have to say, how does the axion interact with stuff that we can see and observe? Because dark matter, very, very weakly interacting. It just passes right through. We can't see it, touch it, feel it, smell it, taste it, whatever. So the nice thing is the axion is predicted to have what we call a coupling or an interaction with photons, which are particles of light. So we can essentially engineer the optimal conditions to stimulate axion to photon conversion and then try and catch the little photons that come out. And so in a slightly more poetic sense, we take the dark matter and we turn it into little flashes of light. And then we look for those little flashes of light. So our detector looks like a, in this case, it is a little cylinder of metal, specifically high conductivity copper. And the idea there is that when the axion converts into a photon, that little light particle will essentially be trapped and bounce around inside our cylinder of metal. And some energy will build up inside the cavity because the photons are bouncing around. And then we have a little electromagnetic field probe inside the cavity that is reading out the electromagnetic energy inside the cavity. And if we see a little bump above the background that we expect, we attribute that to potentially a dark matter interaction. And then there's all kinds of stuff we would do to validate that rather than just assuming that any little bump we see is dark matter. There's a lot of checks and stuff.
And why does it have to be in an MRI machine?
The reason for that is the large magnetic field generated by the MRI machine is one of the conditions that stimulates that axion to photon conversion that I mentioned before. So the axions come in, they interact with the magnetic field, and then that causes them to convert into these little flashes of light that bounce around inside our chamber.
Okay, so what happens now that the machine's running?
So we are taking data right now. So that is to say our cavity, our detector is inside the MRI, and we've just turned on the readout chain, which is the electronics that reads out the amount of electromagnetic radiation inside the cavity and looks for little blips above the background. And we take data for a while, and then we analyze that data. We tune the detector various times throughout the process. So what we're doing here is not actually dissimilar to tuning a radio receiver in your car. The detector, our little cavity, is only sensitive to certain frequencies of electromagnetic radiation at a time. So we've turned it on at one tuned frequency, and we're sensitive to dark matter at that frequency. So we take some data at this frequency, and then we adjust the frequency of the detector a little bit, and we listen in another little frequency range, and then we listen in another little frequency range. And we do that for, yeah, about a cumulative 48 hours of data taking for this initial run. We're calling it our prototype run, but it is still taking real science data. And then we analyze that data, and we look for any statistical evidence of little spikes, little peaks in the electromagnetic noise above the background level that have certain characteristics that would look like an axion dark matter signature. And then if we see anything, we do a rigorous vetting process. In the event that we don't find anything, what we instead do is called placing exclusion limits. So I said before, there's lots of different ideas about what dark matter is. At the moment, the name of the game is ruling things out. And that is essentially the scientific method. And it narrows down the long list of places that dark matter could be hiding. So we're kind of chasing dark matter to the edges of the universe to try and figure out where it's hiding by operating all of these different detectors and slowly, slowly ruling things out. I don't look at a null result as a failure of an experiment. But of course, if we do, then you'll probably catch me at a Nobel Prize ceremony sometime. Then.
I expect a ticket, yes. One of my very own.
Sure, yeah, media pass, I'm sure. Yeah, sounds good.
So that tuning to different frequencies and trying different frequencies, that's part of narrowing down where dark matter might be lying.
There's some other confounding factors. So a big one is the fact that we don't know the mass of the particle. So we don't know how heavy the axion is, if indeed it exists. We know how much dark matter there is in total, but we don't know if it's like a small amount of heavy particles or a very large amount of light particles. We know like...
Or a mix of two?
Yeah, that's right. So we also don't know if it's made of multiple different things. But yes, we know like within about a cubic centimeter of space, there's about half a proton's worth of dark matter mass just everywhere. But again, yeah, we don't know if that's one particle that's half a proton or a billion particles that are a billionth of the mass or some combination of many different things, right? So we need to search for axions with lots of different masses. And the way that that works in the context of our experiment is when the dark matter, when the axion converts into that little flash of electromagnetic radiation, the frequency of that radiation is just directly dependent on the axion mass. So our detector is sensitive to a certain frequency, which corresponds to a certain mass of the axion. And so we are just kind of ruling out different potential masses for the axion. The other thing is we don't know how strongly the axion is coupled to photons. So it is what we call in the language of physics a two-dimensional parameter space. But what it effectively just means is we don't know the mass and we don't know the probability of it converting into a photon. So we put limits on both of those things by taking this experiment. So when I say we don't know the mass, we don't know the mass, but we're pretty sure it's very small for the axion. Some of the dark matter candidates can have like larger particles, but the broad community consensus is that if axions exist as dark matter, they have to be really, really, really light. Even the heaviest axions that are predicted in that context are really, really, really small, like way smaller than like even an electron or a subatomic particle like that, really tiny.
Now, this is a prototype experiment. What do you hope for the future?
This experiment is what we're calling the Organ Low Frequency Pathfinder experiment. It's our first run for axions in this mass range, and we are using it both as a way to take science data, but also as a way to learn about these detector designs. This is the first detector of its kind. We kind of had to design it from scratch. So we're doing the first run, and we've learned a lot already, and our ultimate goal is to scale the thing up in size by a factor of 5 in every dimension. So it'll be like a meter long and 20 to 40 centimeters in diameter, and then we will be much, much more sensitive just because there'll be just more dark matter inside the thing. So bigger cavity, better for dark matter. We put it in the MRI and we do basically exactly the same thing. That's the next goal, and that will be a larger run over both more axion mass range and also more sensitive. And then ultimately, I would love to make all kinds of upgrades to this thing. Our dominant noise background is just the thermal radiation that's coming off all of the parts in the experiment. If you have ever looked through a thermal imaging camera, then you know that anything that has any temperature is constantly emitting some small amount of light. And that's also true for our experiment. So the actual cavity itself is emitting some background sea of photons of radiation that can wash out our signal. So if we can make the whole thing colder, it will get much more sensitive. So would love to do that as well.
Now, you mentioned the name of this experiment has the word organ in it, but there's also an organ dark matter detector in WA, isn't there?
The organ experiment is Australia's axion detector effort at the moment. It was initially run at the University of Western Australia, and the main organ mainline experiment is still there. And this is the low frequency offshoot. So we are looking in a different region of axion parameter space.
Yeah, this is not your first dark matter detector rodeo, because you were involved in the Western Australian experiment. Can you just sort of describe how that's similar or different to this one and how that's gone?
So the organ experiment, the what we now call organ main, was a big part of my PhD training and then my postdoc work at the University of Western Australia. And yeah, I'm still connected to that experiment. We've expanded with my move over here and we've become a collaboration, nationwide collaboration. There's kind of a suite of experiments that live inside the organ name at the moment. But yeah, our flagship experiment is still organ main, which is the one over at UWA. The main difference between that experiment and this one is the frequency range. So we're looking for very low frequency axions or low mass axions. Those guys are looking at the other end in the very high frequency range or high mass axions.
So just say, I don't know, next week you get a blip and it looks like the mass of an axion is, I don't know, X, whatever the unit of measurement is. If you get that confirmed through other experiments, other teams, yeah, then what happens?
Yeah, well, that would be a monumental shift in our understanding of the universe. The big thing for me about it is that it's such a huge unknown, and we need to figure out what it is before we start asking what it can do. Because I don't know, I always like to say, like, if you like look around, right, at like the history of humanity and all the stuff we've done, some of it not awesome, but lots of it cool. Modern medicine, space travel, all of art and literature, anything that has ever moved you on this planet. And consider the fact that we have done that with an understanding of just 1/6 of the matter in the universe. And there is 5 times as much again of this invisible stuff called dark matter, and we just don't know what it is. So to me, the idea that we shouldn't be looking for it is kind of crazy. We need to figure out what that stuff is. The idea that it won't be useful, I think, is pretty wild. And yeah, just imagine what we could do if we could unlock that huge, huge portal of all of the matter in the universe.
Ben McAllister, a physicist at Swinburne University. He's actually on parental leave at the moment. His baby came around the same time as the detector was switched on. So he's left his PhD students, Raj and Paige, in charge. So I dropped them a line earlier this week just to see how it was all going, and they reported that the detector has been collecting data at different frequencies, as it should. Whether they do find anything, ever, remains to be seen, but we'll keep on top of this story. And if any listeners happen to have a spare MRI machine lying around, Ben's team would love to hear from you.
Recycling medical equipment to help the cause of physics. How splendid. I recycle to help the planet. This morning I went to the local supermarket with my old shopping bag and a bunch of light plastic remains, which I put in the shop's bin. And I am yet to ask the friendly staff what happens to it. Thomas Maschmeyer at the University of Sydney knows. He's a chemist who's won the Prime Minister's Prize for Innovation in 2020, both for recycling wastes and for gel-ion batteries, which have jelly instead of liquids to be a safer and more versatile option for our energy needs. So far, so fine. But the challenge in Australia is, okay, we're very inventive, but development and markets are so bloody tricky. So what is gel-ion? Tom Ashmeyer.
The advantage, we are now a sulfur cathode material battery and we are faster in terms of charging, we are lighter and we are cheaper and we don't blow up.
And what is the cathode?
The cathode is the opposite to the anode in a battery, so you've got a plus and you've got a minus.
But it's made of sulfur?
It is made out of sulfur and carbon. The carbon is intricately incorporated and so together they form a material that can store and release electrons.
There was some talk of using sodium as well.
That's right. So that would be the anode part, and the sodium would move towards the cathode upon discharge, and we can use either lithium or sodium.
And why a jelly?
The jelly gives it structural integrity. It doesn't crack because it's a jelly, but at the same time, it is very, very condensed, not as thin as a liquid. And so overall, we get the best of both worlds. We call it a semi-solid state.
And you can use it as part of the structure of the house, if you like.
That was when we were looking at zinc bromide chemistry, which we since have pivoted away from.
So you've got it discrete, as you would any other battery.
That's right. We're now a drop-in technology for existing gigafactories to replace existing cathode active materials, which are the materials you coat on the cathode electrode.
So has it, in terms of rewards, done well in the market?
It did well at the IPO in London, at the London's alternative investment stock market. We got the Omicron phase of COVID, which didn't do so well for pre-revenue tech companies. And after that, we had the Ukraine war. And after that, now most recently, we have the Iran war. So non-revenue tech companies are not looking too hot on the stock market right now, but our time will come very soon.
Through investment, we hope.
Yes, so we have investment from a wonderful set of investors, initial investors who took us to market. We are very grateful for them, and we are increasingly getting large international funds investing in us and believing in us. And we're also having partners like TDK, the world's largest electronics company in Japan, who's our global partner to roll out the technology.
So is it really an Australian company or is it an international one?
It started out as a University of Sydney spin-out, so it's definitely an Australian company. But to really be successful in the global marketplace, you have to reach out and try and identify the best technology around. And what we currently have, the material has actually been invented by Professor Marcus Antonietti, director of a Max Planck Institute in Germany.
That's a good, amazing outfit to be associated with.
Yes, we are very, very proud to be associated with that institute and also with the person as a good personal friend. And yeah, he's the most highly cited chemist in Germany. So he knows what he's doing. And we've taken a license to the material, taken it into the company and improved it since and made it into a really strong commercial proposition in terms of performance, energy density, and also in terms of manufacturability.
As for yourself, you a few years ago won the Prime Minister's Prize for Innovation. And sometimes I wonder whether you are still a complete professor or a business person?
No, I would say I'm still a complete professor. The academic heart beats strongly, but my strong interest also at the later stages of our career is to have impact. So for impact, we need to try to translate the technology. But we do that with a group of fundamentally wonderful students and postdocs and academic colleagues from which we can launch our ideas and then reach out into the business side and connect the two elements to create that impact.
The batteries themselves, are they for any person building on a bigger scale or are they perhaps even for the private person?
Yes, so this is the exciting part about cathode active material. We are able to pair with just about any anode active material, and the anode material tends to dictate what the battery is used for. So we are good for grid storage, we are good for drones, we are good for electric vehicles, we're good for personal electronics. So we are a real chameleon that can go into all of those markets because we are so cheap and our performance is so high. We are very fast at loading and charging and discharging. So we can go between 20 and 80% state of charge within 2 minutes, which people don't believe. We can also go down to minus 40 degrees, which is something else people have got trouble believing. So you show them the data and then slowly the belief comes and then slowly partnerships like with TDK arrive.
So is everybody around the country, in Australia perhaps, using JELiON batteries without perhaps knowing it?
Not yet. So to introduce a battery at global scale requires gigafactories. They are between 10 and 100 gigawatt hours a year of production. That is a process that takes 10 years or so to really complete. So we are in the process of rolling out the material, building pilot plants with partners. And once we have the pilot plants, we have enough material for that to be tested by potential battery manufacturer partners. And once we have the confidence of that, one can start to think about putting the very large investments to either build new factories or somewhat less investment to adapt existing factories.
So much for batteries, which are doing really famous work. But similarly, a while ago, we talked about the recycling of plastic, the difference between the light plastic that you get, say, in supermarkets and you take your own back to be, who knows, possibly recycled, although there seems to be a little doubt about where that material goes. And the other sort of plastic, which is the firmer, harder plastic, which is harder as well to recycle. What's the difference?
So in our case, there is no difference, so we can take all. For our recycling solution, there doesn't need to be a separation of plastics. We can take it unsorted. But of course, there should be a differential approach towards recycling. So it's something I can easily recycle, say, milk bottles, and I can easily separate them out. Why wouldn't I just do that, remelt the plastic, and have a very low energy path towards the reuse? That is fantastic. Let's not interfere with that. But then there's all the leftover plastics, which is about 80%. And we can take that and make that into oils, waxes, and lubrication agents, which we can sell into the existing petrochemical industry for them to either make new plastics, you know, new ethylene from naphtha we can give them, or other petrochemical products.
So why is so much being thrown out or thrown away or just dumped?
That is, of course, shocking, and we are trying to make our contribution for that to stop. We have a plant in the from our license holder, Mura Technology, in the UK, that is going through commercial commissioning. It's a plant of about 20,000 tonnes a year size, with modules going up to 80,000 tonnes a year. And once that is properly online, hopefully we will have enough confidence in the financial community to view it as a bankable project. And once it's a bankable project, it becomes an insurable project, and the money should be more easy to get to actually roll it out on a global scale.
Well, a couple of years ago, there was something like a scandal because of the material of the light plastic being found just stored in warehouses somewhere rather than going where it should be to be recycled. What's the state of that scheme now?
Yeah, I think that had a bad end, and I think some of the warehouses even caught fire. I think it's still stored in part above ground. Certainly in Germany, that is still the case. A lot of recycled plastic is just stored, waiting for solutions. And we, of course, have those solutions. And the world has understood that. So Mitsubishi Chemical in Japan is building under license a plant. LG Chem in South Korea is building a plant. And Dow is a global partner rolling out the technology as well. All at that stage of 20,000 tons a year to showcase the commercial viability and the length of operation.
Well, the message seems to be that young people given a chance to do something effective, and I've seen that in our local high school down the south coast in Kiama, where they were shown, actually by ABC television, Craig Rucastle, shown how to recycle, and they saved the school, I think, something like $90,000 in a year, following the normal rules about what to do. And it seems to be with those light plastics, you just bung them together, melt them down a bit and use them again, or what?
Yes, it depends what type of light plastic. So if they are quite pure, that's the thing to do. If I have a very reasonably pure grade of polyethylene, for example, then there's no reason not to melt it down and use them again. And that's what I would advocate. The problem comes when there are mixed plastics. For example, films used in meat packaging, and they are up to 6 different plastic films stuck together to take care of different elements of gas diffusion, water diffusing out, oxygen diffusing in, UV protection, all sorts of things. And they can't be recycled in that manner. And when I have mixed end-of-life plastics, which have got bits of styrofoam packaging, bits of meat tray, bits of plastic bag, to pull that all apart is a very energy-intensive process, and then it doesn't make sense to try and do that. So you've got to take the whole thing as a mixture. Currently, that's either burned or landfilled, and what we are offering is a true circular path for those carbons to end up back in the supply chain.
I may be naive, but I've got a vague image of lots of enthusiastic young people being asked to do this stuff like they did in the school. That was a matter of sorting it into the right bins. But there are ways in which you can have mucky exercises, for instance, with tree planting, the Miyawaki forests we talked about on the science show, pioneered in Japan and certainly here, where young people like to help.
Yes, the problem with us to be commercially viable, we need to have at least 120,000 tons a year. So it's really about collecting. That's an important part people can help, but also trying to reduce single-use plastics or agitate for plastics which have designed into them either a biodegradability or a more easy recyclability. So citizens' action groups in that sense are very important. But in terms of the leftover materials that we currently have in the supply chain, for that we need this large, deep industry.
Final question to you personally. You're doing work here, clearly, if it works for the public good. Where did that inspiration come from for you?
Yes, thank you for that question. When I came back from overseas in 2003 by Sydney University, I was asked to give a course on sustainable chemistry. And I felt I could not stand in front of the students in the view of climate change and everything if I didn't try to have a go myself. So from that, I was inspired to try and set up some companies that would go for impact. So the plastics one, the battery one, but also Licella, the biomass waste to sustainable aviation fuel, where we have a pilot plant in Canada linked to pulp and paper waste. They came from that.
Thank you. We'll keep in touch.
Thank you very much.
Tom Ashmire, Professor of Chemistry at the University of Sydney, showing how a scientist can adapt to the often unforgiving complexities of the market and translating bright ideas.
Finally this week, a big loss to lovers of comedy and the birding community. Bill Oddie died in July. When I was living in London as a fresh-faced uni graduate, I remember watching him presenting Springwatch on the BBC. Did you ever work with him, Robin?
I did, several times, once as a Salvation Army bandsman.
No way, really?
Yes, it made me miss the birth of my child. I was 2 hours late for Tom being born on the 29th of October 1971.
What a story.
And off and on, his love of nature, Bill's, I mean, and of birds, helped him banish several depressions now and then. He discussed it at the Science Show in his inimitable way.
True to form and stupidly, I had no sooner landed than, having had about an hour's sleep, I realised I sort of had the first day off when I should have been getting over jet lag and insisted on going out then. So I went out to the wonderful Werribee sewage farm near Melbourne, which always sounds like a joke, but it's actually one of the most amazing bird places I've ever seen. I mean, it's just this fantastic place for wildfowl and waders and so on and so forth. And indeed, little endangered species, orange-bellied parrots hang about there as well, which is very rare species, of course. I've just been in Western Australia. We went down to the Two Peoples Bay Sanctuary near Albany and then had a couple of days off, and the weather was just fantastic, and had a wonderful drive back through the Stirling Ranges and stopped off at lots of places. So having, and then I came back in to Sydney last night and went to TV studio, and the world was still out there, and stupid English football hooligans were at it again, and Yugoslavia was still in a mess, and George Bush was saying stupid things, and I just thought, oh God, it's still going on out there.
It's very disappointing, isn't it? But back in Western Australia, what was the highlight there?
Well, I suppose the highlight was visiting a rather legendary place with a rather legendary bird. Down at Two Peoples Bay, this is the home of the noisy scrub bird. It sounds like one of these things that we made up, but it's absolutely true. And it's rather a romantic bird, and a romantic story in a way, because this is a bird that was thought to be extinct and was rediscovered in that area in about 1970. People thought, God, it still exists. They then had a look in that area to see whether there were any more. And much to everyone's surprise, there really weren't any apart from this one area. You know, it's literally only sort of a few square kilometres, really, down in the Two Peoples Bay area. And it's become a sort of symbol, I suppose, of what man can do to help a bird that's seriously endangered. Obviously, it had just been rediscovered and there weren't very many, so it would be very easy to wipe it out again. So there's been a considerable program over the last 20 odd years there to increase the numbers and now to spread them into rather safer places.
And I tracked down the actual noise of the noisy scrubby bird at the Australian Museum, and here it is.
Bill Oddie, he had such a passion for music, once more linked to science birdsong.
Next week on The Science Show, it will be National Science Week. Yes, Robin, I know it's Science Week every week on The Science Show, but the ABC Science Week project this year is one that's pretty close to your heart, I think. It's on wildflowers, and I'll be bringing you some stories of some of the wildest wildflowers we have. The ABC is also running a poll to find Australia's favourite, most amazing wildflower. So head to abc.net.au/wildflowers to check out our shortlist and vote for your favourite. The winner will be announced on Radio National in a live countdown from noon on Friday, August 21st, with me and Anne Jones.
Okay, and here's for the wattle. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.